The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I remain Bob McChesney, your host today, coming for you from Campbell Hall in Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, joining us from this phone, from his home on the phone in Boulder, Colorado, is David Barsamian. David Barsamian is the founder and director of Alternative Radio, an independent, award-winning weekly radio program that he produces in Boulder, Colorado. Alternative Radio presents information and perspectives that are ignored or distorted in the corporate-controlled media. The one-hour program is broadcast on more than 125 public radio stations around the world. Barsamian is also the national producer of Making Contact, another weekly radio program. His interviews and articles appear in The Progressive, The Nation, Z, and other journals and magazines. Barsamian is the author of numerous books with Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and Edward Said. His series of books with Chomsky, America's leading dissident, have sold in the hundreds of thousands and have been translated into many languages. David Barsamian's latest books are Propaganda in the Public Mind, Conversations with Noam Chomsky, and The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting. David, are you there?
I'm indeed here, and I'm thrilled to be on Media Matters, where Straight No Chaser is the theme music.
Well, we were thinking of you when we were trying to pick out a theme song. We wanted a song that would appeal to the older generation.
Well, thanks. I'm an inveterate monkophile.
Very good. That's great.
Thelonious Monk really had a big influence on me in a very indirect way, if you want me to go off on a tangent.
Well, sure. Go right ahead.
In 1963-64, I was working in the East Village in New York at a cafe, and the cafe would close at 12, and I'd go right next door to the Five Spot, where Monk was holding court every night with Charlie Rouse on tenor saxophone.
The legendary quartet.
Yeah, the great quartet of that time. And I just was watching Monk and listening to him every night. I'd stay there until the place closed at 4. And I learned about the value of being eccentric and also innovative and not really looking over your shoulder, because Monk was a singular figure in jazz, and his compositions were almost bordering on atonality. And he had a very peculiar sense of how to compose. And I just learned a lot about him, about being fearless, about doing your thing, about not worrying about what the critics may say.
David Barsamian joins us on Jazz Hour today. you know, I agree completely. That's why he's our theme music. I'm a huge Monk fan as well. Although I don't know if he had quite that influence on me, he should have, but he was one of the giant figures of jazz and one of the great contributors to American culture. David, you are a real man of letters, a Renaissance man. You do the show Alternative Radio. You're an author, an interviewer. You can speak on almost any subject concerning media and much else, in politics for that matter. What I'd like you to do to start today is just to talk about your recent book, The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, which I've had the privilege to read. And it's been out now for about a year, is that right?
Yeah, it's been out about a year, and it's gotten quite a bit of coverage, actually, including an interview on WILL during one of the weekday noon interview programs.
So that's Focus 580 with David Inge.
Yes, and the host was, I mean, he was very sympathetic, as well as most of the callers, and that kind of repeats itself around the country when I'm on NPR stations. There's quite a bit of, first of all, appreciation for NPR and for its being there, but also quite a bit of dis-ease, discomfort about the direction NPR and PBS, the TV counterpart, have moved in recent years. And that's the topic of my book. You know, I'm sorry to report that NPR and PBS, even more egregiously, have really distanced themselves from their founding principles, which, if you look at, are quite remarkable.
Now, when were these founding principles drafted, and what were they for both National Public Radio and public broadcasting?
Well, they were drafted by I would say, the creme de la creme of the American establishment in 1967. It was the Carnegie Commission report. And this report was written not by Noam Chomsky or Edward Herman or Alexander Coburn, but by people like James Conant, the head of Harvard, the head of Eastman Kodak, the president of MIT, those kinds of upper echelon elite Americans.
What we used to call the establishment.
The establishment, indeed. In this case, the Eastern establishment particularly. And they had a vision. If you read their comments, it's quite startling. They said that public broadcasting in the United States, first of all, should be non-commercial. That was very unambiguous. And the enabling legislation, which passed 9 months after the Carnegie Commission report came out, also used those terms in very unambiguous language, non-commercial. There was to be no advertising. There was no such thing as enhanced underwriting and more enhanced underwriting as they have now. And the Carnegie Commission report said that the goal of public broadcasting should be to give voice to those in the community who may otherwise be unheard, and to be a forum for controversy and debate. And I think that's terrific. I think that's what public broadcasting should be about. It should be controversial. It should be pushing the envelope. It should be putting the corporate control media back on its heels. It should be there as a kind of a tonic, an elixir to counteract the propagandistic formulations that are the staple of corporate control media. And when I use the term corporate control media, I remember about 15 years ago when I first started using it, there was a program director, and since we're in speaking in Illinois, I can say who he is. In Maine, a very big NPR network there, and he said, "I don't like you using this term. It's very biased." I said, "You think it's biased? Why do you think it's biased?" Well, it just shows that you have a particular agenda. But and then I tried to explain to him about Bagdikian's work, a media monopoly, that there were the corporate media control of media in the U.S. was just in the hands of a few corporations, and he was kind of dismissive. In recent years, I must say that he has mellowed to the point where even he is using that term.
All right, very good. We're talking to David Barsamian today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David, right now, is talking about his new book, The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting. Later in the show, we'll be talking about his recent essay called General Media, which is on how the military is sort of manipulating and managing the press coverage of the prospective war in Iraq. And we'll also talk about his work with Noam Chomsky, his general critique of the media, and a trip you've made to India. So we've got a lot on the agenda today. If you'd like to call in and make a comment or ask a question to David Barsamian, the number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455, and the lines are open. So, David, we've got this great charter that the establishment comes up with back in the late 60s that you think would be an awfully good mandate for exactly what we need in the way of public radio and public TV. What happened?
Well, the language was actually incorporated into the enabling congressional legislation, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, which incidentally was the last piece of major legislation, Great Society legislation of Lyndon Johnson's administration. But almost from the get-go, public radio and TV were sabotaged by the whole idea of, well, how do you fund such a network in the United States? And this became a lightning rod for controversy. And the Wilbur Mills, who was the chair of the very powerful House Appropriations Committee.
In the top party animal in Washington.
Yes, And also, you know, this is at the time of the Vietnam War, and Johnson's coming under increasing pressure from the public about the war, and so he needed congressional support for funding, particularly Mills's support, as well as other conservatives, in which it's important to remember, at that time, virtually every single committee in the House and the Senate were controlled by Southern Democrats. Not just the House of the Military, the House Military Committee, the Intelligence Committee. The Southern Democrats had a stranglehold on the key levers of power in Washington, and they did not want to surrender their ability to control the purse, to control the funding mechanism. So what the Carnegie Commission report, again, I think brilliantly projected and proposed, was that public TV and radio in the U.S. have forward funding, that there be a heat shield, because they understood very well, I mean, these were political animals themselves, the people that wrote this report, that this new system would be very vulnerable to political manipulation and coercion. So what they did, so they proposed that there be forward funding and that the monies be insulated for a period of, say, 5 years at a time to allow stations to plan, to hire staff, to acquire equipment and things like that.
Develop a listenership and a viewership, too.
Exactly. But the Congress would have nothing of the sort. They insisted on controlling it, and that has been a central problem because immediately it came under ideological attack for being what is curiously called too liberal. NPR comes on the air in May of 1971. Its initial broadcast, incidentally, was covering the May Day demonstrations in Washington, D.C. And I think there, if you go back and listen to it, and I have, you get a glimpse of what NPR can really do if it's not worrying about, regents that control its license, or senators, or congressmen, or people like Newt Gingrich, who denounced it as, you know, a sandbox for the elite. What it could really do, so they were covering the demonstrations in Washington from the perspective of the people in the street. It's a kind of Howard Zinn approach to doing radio and to doing broadcasting from the people who were being impacted, who were actually out there, not from the experts from Columbia and Princeton and Stanford and you know, the golden Rolodex, the punditocracy, as they're called, who pronounce their ideas about what's going on, usually from an air-conditioned studio miles away from where the action actually is. So that, I think, you know, that probably unnerved them very much, the people, who wanted a very pliant public broadcasting. They had a vision, I must say. The conservatives, they do have a vision of what PBS and NPR should be like. It should be game shows. It should be African animals without Africans. It should be Antiques Roadshow, Lawrence Welk reruns. I'm not making this up. This is actually in Denver. The public TV station actually airs Lawrence Welk and Ed Sullivan reruns, if you can believe that. Here at a time when there's some incredible documentaries being made, they don't get on PBS because they're completely intimidated. They don't want to rock the boat. They're very conservative. They're only concerned about, securing their next paycheck. And that paycheck is coming primarily through Congress and more through corporate underwriting. In other words, corporate advertising, Archer Daniels Midland, AT&T, all the major, Solomon Barney, all the major stockbrokers in New York, investment houses, are heavily investing now in advertising, particularly on PBS, also on NPR, because these are the kind of elite audiences that they want to reach. So it's the whole thing has become very, I'm sorry to say, compromised.
Mm-hmm.
And money is at the core of it.
Okay. Let me just say, let our listeners know, you're listening to David Barsamian, my guest today on Media Matters. I'm the host, Bob McChesney. David is the author of the new book, The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, along with a host of other books, including several interview books with Noam Chomsky. He's also the senior producer of Alternative Radio, the founder and director of Alternative Radio, an independent award-winning weekly radio program produced in Boulder, Colorado, that's carried by 125 public radio stations around the world. If you'd like to call in and ask David a question, he is conversant and an expert on all sorts of things related to media and politics. The number is 333-9455. And our toll-free number, statewide or national, for that matter, is 800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Chicago, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Barsamian, good to hear from you again. And wonderful program, Alternative Radio. I can hear it on WILL all the way here in Chicago sometimes, especially in the summer. In line with what you just said, I did an online search a couple of days ago when I learned that Now with Bill Moyers was being moved in Chicago to 10 p.m., and some friends and I were angry about that. I found that Madison, Wisconsin runs it at 10 p.m., but most other stations in the entire region run it during prime time. But Peoria, which I'm also familiar with, runs Lawrence Welk, and it runs Antiques Roadshow, as Channel 11 does in Chicago, during prime time to catch that audience you're speaking of. POV, another outstanding documentary that I follow, is run off prime time on Channel 11 in Chicago. Never in prime time. Very disturbed about that, and I don't contribute, I'm afraid to say. My question is, I met you several years ago at a conference in Chicago on community radio, if you'll recall that. It was, I think, American Friends Service Committee and others put that together. Could you comment on what is the status of community-based radio? Who's supporting it? Who's originating it? I'm talking about these small stations. And who's attacking it? Who's denying their right to exist?
Well, that's a great question. David, perhaps you could start by just distinguishing community radio in that tradition from NPR and the public radio tradition.
Yeah, there are two different streams. They're kind of all lumped together as public radio. But NPR, incidentally, is a content provider. It does its most well-known programs are Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Those are its bookends, as it were. And it has about 400 member stations. You have to pay a very significant amount of money to broadcast NPR programs. People also may know Prairie Home Companion and This American Life and BBC News. That comes from another content provider known as Public Radio International in St. Paul, Minneapolis. So those are the two major content providers. But let's focus on NPR because they are far and away the biggest network in the country. They have about 400 member stations. And primarily, the stations are staffed by paid professionals. And there is very little community or volunteer input. Let me give you a perfect example firsthand here in Colorado, because we have this kind of laboratory experiment, as it were. In Denver, there is KCFR, also calls itself Colorado Public Radio. It has wall-to-wall NPR programming. It has no local news, I mean none. It has very little even statewide or regional news. Its only concession to even being in this region is a daily one-hour interview program on some local topic. So the rest of the time, it has become a kind of repeating station for NPR programming. And it's not just Morning Edition and All Things Considered. It's also all these game shows, Wait, Don't Tell Me, What Do You Know? There's also Talk of the Nation, which is on every day, Terry Gross's Fresh Air, which is on every day. So there's a whole range of what they call news and information and what I call news and infotainment programming. And so those stations are very different from community radio stations. We have one here in Boulder where I live and where I kind of grew up, and I know you were involved in a community radio station in Madison, WORT. These are two perfect examples and very successful models of community radio, people that actually in the community program the programs themselves. They organize the programming. They actually do the programming. They're often volunteers. They're not paid. And they take risks. I have to say that straight out. They really do provide alternative information, the kind of information you're not going to find in Time or Newsweek, but you may find in Z Magazine or The Progressive. They take chances. They bring voices on the air that you won't hear. People like Ward Churchill and Russell Means and John Trudell, people from the Native American community, people from the Latino community like Dolores Huerta and Juan Gonzalez and people like that. So you get to hear many different voices. I think community radio in the United States is much closer to the spirit and the letter of the Carnegie Commission report of 1967, because they are providing a forum for those who may otherwise be unheard. That's the exact language, a forum for those who might otherwise be unheard.
David, how many of these community radio stations are there in the United States approximately?
Well, it's quite an interesting story. You know, there are about 50 or 60 of them around the country.
We have one right here in Champaign-Urbana.
EFT in Champaign-Urbana. There's the biggest one is WMNF in Tampa-St. Pete, in a city of about 3 million. They're in small towns like Boonville, California, and Blue Hill, Maine. And they're in mid-sized cities like Madison and Boulder, Colorado, and in big cities, the Pacifica Network has 5 stations in New York, Washington, Houston, L.A., and Berkeley. There's a whole number of cities in the U.S. that really don't have community radio. They have NPR stations, but they don't have community-based radio, and I think that's really unfortunate.
We're talking to David Barsamian today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in, the number is 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. We do have another caller on a car phone, so let's hope that the car is driving in the right direction so we can get through. Line 1, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, gentlemen. Very interesting topic. I've moved around in my career and listened to public radio stations throughout the nation, and I feel very fortunate to be a member and a participant, listener of WILL Radio and watching WILL TV. What I'm interested in knowing is, do you perceive a detriment to having the NPR, the information, the news and infotainment, as well as some of the local programming that WILL is very good at carrying? I see a combination as being very productive, but I almost felt like you kind of slammed Ed Sullivan and Lawrence Welk whenever I get the opportunity to let my kids watch that kind of programming. It's productive in our home, and I'm wondering if you feel the same way.
Well, I think local programming is really important, and I didn't speak to WIAL because I don't know its scheduling, but I do realize that it does do some local programming, and that is very, very valuable, and it should do more. The problem with putting on reruns from 50s television is what you're not seeing on public TV. All of these great documentaries. There's a new one featuring Noam Chomsky called Power and Terror. There's a new one by Danny Schechter on the election shenanigans in Florida. There's a whole series. There's Deadly Deception. There's the Panama Deception. Some of these have won Academy Awards. PBS will not put them on. Why won't they put them on? It's not because they don't have the space or the airtime. It's because politically they see them as too risky and possibly offending corporate sponsors. And I think that's not what public broadcasting should be doing.
All right, David Barsamian, our guest today. David, if I can say one thing, I'd like to switch now Because, you know, our nation is about to, or is prospectively going to be entering a war in the Middle East. I know you've been writing about this quite a bit. You've more than almost anyone I know, have followed politics, international politics for decades, especially in the Middle East. You've followed it. You've written about it. You've done interviews with people on it. And you've recently just finished an essay on the press coverage, the media coverage of the prospective war in Iraq and the region. And I wonder if you could just give us your analysis. What's your sense of what's going on there, what the U.S. is doing, and then how the U.S. news media have been covering events there?
Well, I think, generally speaking, the American public is being carpet-bombed with an unprecedented campaign of propaganda about, you know, what is evolving in the Middle East, particularly in regard to Iraq, where the level of lying is truly breathtaking. Now, this is not...
Give some examples, if you can.
Sorry?
What are some examples of the breathtaking lies?
Well, one is that whenever Rumsfeld goes on television and says the United States is enforcing no-fly zones and it's attacking Iraqi sites, no one in the press corps challenges the legality of these no-fly zones. The no-fly zones were unilaterally imposed on Iraq by the United States in the early 1990s. It has absolutely no international juridical or legal standing. I mean, and not a single reporter will get up and say, you know, this is just something as a diktat from the U.S. and is not legal. How can you say this? But no one will do that. And Rumsfeld gets away with lie after lie, like when he said in front of the press corps in Washington just the other day, I was watching, and he was saying that all the neighbors in the region are totally in favor of U.S. military action in Iraq, and that is simply not true. Of course, one neighbor is very enthusiastic, and that's Israel. But Iran is totally against it. Turkey had to be bought off with billions of dollars in new economic aid and also a promise from the U.S. that it will push it into the European Union. The other countries in the region, Egypt is against it, and Syria, etc., they're very, very hesitant. They see the enormous consequences that a major U.S. military action could have. In mid-December, I don't know if you saw this propagandistic film called Live from Baghdad. It was on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
It was reporting, you know, the Peter Arnett, Bernard Shaw reporting from Baghdad during the first Gulf War in January 1991. In this much ballyhooed feature film, the Iraqi incubator story was repeated. I mean, this is really shocking. I mean, that this kind of totally fabricated lie could now again have an afterlife. Let me just tell the story very briefly. The Kuwaiti embassy in Washington, D.C. hired a public relations firm, Hill & Knowlton, to stage not a congressional hearing. Actually, it was called a caucus with pliant members of Congress. And at this supposedly congressional hearing, it was not a hearing, it was a caucus meeting, a tearful 15-year-old girl is brought forward and is weeping, and the and she's asked, well, why, you know, why are you so upset? And she said that, you know, she saw, she worked in a hospital in Kuwait, Iraq invaded, and then the troops came into the hospital, into the maternity ward, and took 315 incubators and dumped the babies onto the floor. And then she broke into tears. Well, after the war, this was relieved. This was revealed to be totally fabricated. The girl was, in fact, the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, Sauda Sabah. She was not even in Kuwait at the time of this incident. It was totally fabricated and repeated, and I was just stunned to see that HBO in December 2002 is recycling these old propaganda lies.
You know, David, I should add that I just got an email yesterday from the group Fairness in Action Reporting that sort of highlighted this exactly what you're saying. And HBO has now put a little addenda at the end of the film saying that the incubator story has not been proven. So it sort of acknowledges that this is a bogus story without exactly saying it or changing the piece.
It's not only in the film, which is what people see. You know, I mean, the damage is done. It was broadcast nationwide in December. People don't hang around for the credits and the little, you know, addendums at the end of films. You could barely see them anyway. So I think, you know, the damage has been done. Saddam Hussein is a monster. We have to do something about him. And, you know, Bush has got this incredible media right now that is servile to
the
administration position.
Yeah, why is, assuming, let's say, the press is basically spoon-feeding us the administration position, why is that? Why aren't we getting a more critical press covering something as important as whether we're going to go to a war?
I mean, I think that is the fundamental question, and I wrestle with this question all the time. And when I interview Chomsky and other media experts, I ask this very question: do these guys really know the score and are covering up? Or are they truly as moronic and as imbecilic as they seem to be? I think it's a combination of the two, quite frankly. I don't think we have a very well-informed press corps, particularly when it comes to international issues. And I would just draw your attention to the vast disparity between reporting on international issues in the United States and reporting on the same issues in Britain. So you have two English-speaking countries, and the level of knowledge, the level of information, I think, is substantially different. And, you know, then the question arises, well, why is that so? Why is, you know, British reporting so much significantly better than American reporting on international issues? Well, I think part of it has to do with the control of the media by a handful of corporations. But also, I think we have to talk about, the United States empire and people being part of that imperial system in which they are greatly rewarded if they play ball, if they don't ask the uncomfortable questions, if they don't push the Secretary of State. And there's no question of pushing Bush because he never gives any press conferences. Has anyone even noticed this? Has this even been commented on, that there is never any presidential press conferences? I think he's given a handful since he assumed office, certainly in the single digits. I mean, they won't let him out alone for fear of his putting his famous foot in his mouth, like he knows how it is to put table on the food for families.
Okay, we're talking to David Barsamian today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Barsamian's the head of Alternative Radio, the award-winning weekly radio program that's carried on 125 public stations, the author of numerous books, many interview books with Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn, Edward Said, people like that, as well as a book he wrote called The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting. We have a couple callers I want to get to, but for those of you who'd like to call in, the number here is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Let me just take this moment, if I can, to remind our listeners that if you'd like to get a weekly email update of who our guests are going to be on Media Matters, and if you'd like to get links then to their writings and interviews with them and find out more about them, you can do so by simply going to my website, robertmcchesney.com, and there's a link right on the homepage. You just click it and you can sign up. We'll send you one email a week. There'll be no commercialism, nothing like that. It's just a way to stay on top of the show. We have some great shows coming up, by the way. 2 weeks from today, we have Norman Solomon, who just returned from Iraq with Sean Penn, on the air to talk about the what's going on in Iraq from his experience there. 3 weeks from today, the radio journalist and writer Laura Flanders will be on the air. 4 weeks from today, Mark Cooper will be on the air to talk about the World Social Forum, which he'll be covering for us more or less. And that'll be on February 2nd. And then a month or so from today, February 9th, 5 weeks from today, Eric Alderman will be on to talk about the myth of the liberal media and talk about his new book. Let's go to the phone lines now, though, if we can. Line one, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Sorry, I just had to take a person at the door.
Okay.
Good afternoon. I made this point a couple of weeks ago on the show, but I think it's worth saying again. The commentary on the HBO from the Fair Report, I didn't actually view it, but the synopsis actually shows that story as being showing how CNN is being duped by the Iraqis. So it's not only pernicious in all those ways, but it also reinforces this idea that, you know, CNN is being duped to be anti-U.S. policy. So it's even more pernicious. You've mentioned the countries around Iraq as being unsupportive, except the ones that we can buy off easily. But another unreported story, I'm sure you'll agree, is the amount of constant and consistent protests there is in this country. And I just wanted to mention for Chicago listeners that on grassrootvoices.org, the Quakers website up there, you can find a list of weekly events. You can find information about the protests that are a little bit of information about the protest for the Bush visit on Tuesday, where he's going to unveil his economic but not stimulating package. So there's a lot of that, and we have the battle here locally. But the other pernicious thing about the manipulation of the media at the time of the first Iraq war was the fact that people don't recall that in the House the war declaration only passed by 7 votes, and 4 of the members in their statement at the time of voting mentioned the baby incubator story. So it looks like it was perhaps indeed pivotal, along with all the other propaganda. Some comments on that, but I also wanted you to directly address another problem with NPR, and that's the fact that we have pretty much a apparatchik like Kevin Close, I believe is his name, who came from the USIA. He came from the U.S. Information Agency, the people that run Radio Free Europe and all that in the past and do the Voice of America. So I see that as entirely pernicious, and I can't help but also mention, and then I will hang up and let someone else call in, that now we have this underwriting from the Sugar Confederation. I don't know if those did a number on you when I hear those on the top of the headline news from the National Service. Sugar.org, 16 calories per teaspoon, and absolutely no nutrients otherwise, they don't add. But anyway, thanks for letting me fulminate, and it's good to speak with you again, David. Keep up the good work, as always, and I think you can pull some things out of that.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I should say that you can hear Alternative Radio on WILL Saturday evenings at 6. I also have a website, alternativeradio.org, alternativeradio.org, and an 800 number, 1-800-444-1977. I've done a whole series of programs on the very topics we're talking about today, particularly the whole issue of propaganda as it's being developed in what promises to be, what the Bush administration is promising, to be permanent war. 50, 60 years is what Cheney has said. That's how long the war on terrorism may last. The caller mentioned Kevin Close. He is indeed the head of NPR. He does have a background of working with a major U.S. Propaganda agency, the Voice of America. Not to be outdone by NPR is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB. The head of CPB is Robert Conrad. He also has a background with these agencies. So here you have, you know, the two very important officials coming with, I think, very questionable credentials in terms of heading up, one, the national public radio system, and the other, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is the major funder for NPR and PBS. That's the conduit that the monies go through, that congressional monies are funneled through to go to NPR and to the NPR member stations.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line 2. Urbana, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting program. I'm glad I'm listening. It seems to me that this sort of thing has been going on for a long time, going back to Vietnam War, Grenada, that ugly invasion of Panama under Bush 1, Kosovo, when we acted as the air force for the Albanian separatists, and now today. I'd like to hear the guest comment on that.
Okay, David?
Well, there's an unmistakable pattern of trying to control the news, to manufacture consent. But we have seen in recent, I would say in the last decade, a very tightly controlled, what I call press corps, not press corps. And this press corps has actually gone along with its own strangulation, with more and more government control. Here and there they may say, you know, we're not getting the kind of access that we used to get, but they're not doing anything. They're not bringing this to the attention of the American people, that they cannot get the interviews, they cannot get the information, that the documents are sealed, that the classified information is not forthcoming. And so, yes, there is a pattern, there's a historical pattern of propaganda, but the tools that the state now has, and the fact that the media are in, particularly international reporting, has been so diminished in the United States because of the takeover of journalism, essentially, by private corporations who are only interested in manufacturing not just consent, but manufacturing dollars to pay more and more dividends to stockholders. So they're closing down bureaus various countries around the world. They're not training journalists. But we don't have journalists that speak Arabic or Farsi or Turkish or Urdu. Why not? The British do. Other countries do. I just came back from India, and I was watching Indian TV and Bangladeshi TV and Pakistani TV, and all of those journalists know several languages. Why don't our journalists learn languages?
That's a very good question.
Which will enable them to be much better reporters on the ground.
All right. We're talking to David Barsamian today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in, we've got lines open at 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. We're going to go back to the toll-free line right now. Eureka, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Thank you. It's real an honor and a privilege to speak with you. I enjoy alternative radio when I can get it in the warm winter months of the year. My question is, and I think you've alluded to it, and you're talking about the pro-Bush, pro-war reporting. Where do they ever come up with these poll data that, what does it suggest, 70, 75% of the American people approve of the job he's doing against the war against terrorism?
Well, I think Norman Solomon has written a very good article on the issue of polls. I, incidentally, have never been polled in my life. I literally meet and know thousands and thousands of people. I've never met anyone who's ever been polled. But leave that aside. I think the questions generate a very predictable answer. So if the lead-up to the question is, given the fact that 3,000 of your fellow Americans were slaughtered, innocents, in the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. That's the preface to the question. And then is, do you think the President of the United States should take action, to defend America against terrorism? And that's, interpreted immediately to be an endorsement for aggressive preemptive warfare. I mean, that's what we're looking at right now. The United States is at the precipice of the greatest imperial expansion, I think, in the history of the world. It is forward positioning bases, military personnel in 60, 70, 80 countries. I just learned they're actually in Nepal now training troops because there's an uprising in Nepal. They're in, of course, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, all of the stans. Of course, the one stan that's left out that people should know about is Pipelinistan, and that's what this war in Iraq is about. That was partly what the war in Afghanistan was about. It's about oil, ladies and gentlemen. It's not about human rights. It's not about any empathy for the oppressed Kurdish minority in Iraq. There's not any empathy for the majority Shia population in Iraq. It's about oil. It's about strategic power. And as Chomsky has pointed out over and over again, the single axis that the United States has turned on since it emerged in 1945 as the supreme economic and military power in the world is oil. In fact, there's a State Department document that says the greatest strategic prize in the history of the world is in the Arabian Peninsula, and we mean to control it.
All right, David Barsamian, today our guest in Media Matters. We have a couple phone lines open. Let's go back to the phones right now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with David Barsamian.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment, and maybe you can comment on this too, but I am right in the middle right now of reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and just really kind of surprised and scared about some of the similarities of the propaganda techniques used by the Nazis and what's going on now. And I guess I just wanted to make that comment. And if you can, you can comment on that. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, I've been talking about this as I travel around the country on my USA tour, the United States of Amnesia tour, similarities between Nazi propaganda techniques and what's going on today. And there are a couple of obvious ones. One is the constant repetition of the official story that we, the victims, are seeking justice. And they, the evildoers, must be brought to justice, and they must be punished. So this good versus evil, black versus white, there's no gray area in there at all. You know, they, the evildoers, hate us. Why? Because we're the beacon of freedom of democracy. So you have this constant repetition. The other thing that goes on, which is very instructive, and for those of you who watched national television on Friday, January 3rd, you had a perfect example of what I call these electronic Nuremberg rallies. An acoustic backdrop, which is something the Nazis were brilliant at doing. You had Bush in Fort Hood, Texas, the largest military base in the United States, with a backdrop of the U.S. flag, a symbol of Fort Hood saying America's Hammer, it's the 1st Cavalry Division headquarters, and all of these camouflaged troops applauding and cheering and saying USA and hoo-ha, and there Bush is saying without, you know, any trace of irony that Iraq represents a grave threat to the United States of America. Now, that's the statement. This statement has not been proven. Is it plausible? Yes, it is plausible. But is it demonstrable? Clearly, the administration has failed in demonstrating that Iraq in any way represents a threat to the United States. And so just constant repetition of Saddam Hussein has used weapons of mass destruction. Yes, he has, with U.S. approval, as a matter of fact, with U.S. support throughout the 1980s. But since we have the corporate media is almost entirely amnesiac in its reporting, in its memory. It has no institutional memory. It does not even recall the fact that the U.S. warmly embraced Saddam Hussein's atrocities throughout the 1980s until he made the fatal mistake of invading Kuwait on August 2nd, 1990.
You know, David, the caller, though, I think is the issue. The question even goes beyond the sort of compliance with sort of imperial or foreign adventures by the U.S. government and military operations to a question about, you know, whether our domestic scene is going through some sort of qualitative shift as well, away from the liberal freedoms that I think many Americans are accustomed to and appreciate. Are these under threat, too? I mean, are we in a moment, do you think, historically, of a fundamental shift in how this country operates? Or is this just more business as usual, being the world's biggest military power since 1945?
I think you've put your finger on a very crucial issue. One of the things that the Bush administration and its apparatchiks and the media have been doing is keeping the population on the edge of its seat. We're constantly being alerted. There's green alerts, red alerts, orange alerts. There are searches at airports. There's all kinds of infringements as a result of civil liberties. And I think it's a very dangerous period. And that, too, parallels something that the caller mentioned. I don't want to say this is the 1930s. I'm just saying that there are some similarities. And one of the techniques that the Nazis used was to keep the population in a constant state of fear. And as a result, because of that, they would surrender basic liberties and basic rights. And I think that's something that all Americans, liberal or conservative, libertarian, independent, whatever you might want to call yourself, have to be really alert to right now, because our fundamental freedoms are being undermined. I mean, as we speak, You know, phones are being tapped, emails are being intercepted, houses are being searched without warrants, people are being detained without charges. I mean, this is not 1984. This is not George Orwell's novel. This is the United States of America in 2003. And I think unless people say, you know, we don't want this kind of totalitarian rule in the United States in the name of fighting the war on terrorism. Yes, we want security. Security is reasonable. Everyone wants security. But we do not want to surrender our freedoms, particularly to a state that is more and more invasive into the private activities of individual citizens. I mean, every time you swipe your credit card, the government now can access where you go shopping, what groceries you buy, what videos you check out, what books you get from the library. All of these things, and I'm really concerned that very few conservatives who traditionally say that, you know, they're firmly behind the Bill of Rights, they support the Constitution, have not been heard on this enormous erosion of basic freedoms in our country.
You know, we had David Lindorf on the show last week talking about this issue, and he did point out when we talked about it that there are a couple of prominent conservatives, specifically Dick Armey and Bob Barr, who are leaving Congress and have just left it and are going to work against the Patriot Act or against the sort of invasion of civil liberties for, of all things, the ACLU. So there are a couple of exceptions, but I think your point nonetheless holds. You know, David, we've only got a minute or two left, and I wish we had more time for this, but I think this leads naturally to the subject of India, the world's largest democracy, as it's often called, that unbeknownst, I think, to almost all Americans, is going through an extraordinary period of political turmoil. Can you just give us, in a minute or so, a brief update on what's happening there?
Okay, I'll try and speak as quickly as Amy Goodman, and I know
okay.
I only have a minute. But what's happened is that there's a fundamentalist Hindu organization, the Bharatiya Janata Party, that has power in New Delhi, that is in the central government, and there has been a huge increase in communalism in India, that is, activities directed against India's huge Muslim minority. India has 150 million Muslims. It has many millions of Christians and other minorities, so-called untouchables, the Dalits, the Adivasis, the indigenous people. All of these people are now being targeted as being un-Indian. And if you speak out against the government in something that parallels what's happening here, you are unpatriotic. So India is going through a very precarious period. I'm doing a book with Arundhati Roy, the wonderful novelist and political activist, on some of these issues that South End Press will publish later this year. But I'm very concerned about what's going on in India. I think we have to be very alert to it. And I'm going back there in late February and March.
Can we get you back in there just to talk about India when you get back? Because it is so important, I think, and we've done no service to it today.
I'd love to.
Great. Thank you, David Barsamian. And thank you so much, David, for joining us today on Media Matters. And we'll get to you soon. And I'd like to thank you all for listening to Media Matters. We'll be back next week at this time. 2 weeks from today, we'll have Norman Solomon talking about Iraq. Laura Flanders, 3 weeks from today. You can just go to my website, robertmcchesney.com, and get on our weekly mailing list to always stay on top of who's going to be on the show and who's not, mostly who is. And I'd like to thank Ben Scott, as always, for being the wonderful producer of Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, and I will see you in 167 hours. Bye-bye.